The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.
Hello again and welcome to Tech Weekly. This week on the podcast, we are wired for sound as we sit back and press play on some of the latest software that's transforming the music industry. First of all, author Peter Doggett gives us a whistle-stop tour of the last 100 years of recorded music and the key technological inventions that changed the way we listen to music forever. Imogen Heap is here to save the music industry from collapse with her new project Mycelia, a system that aims to use blockchain to ensure artists get a better deal. And musician, technologist, and inventor of electronic instruments, Tim Exile, is also here to talk about his latest software release, Flesh, which promises to revolutionise the way electronic music is performed. So tune in, turn it up, and sing along. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. So to kick us off, we have Peter Doggett, author on musical history, and we're going to be talking a little bit about the history of technologies that have revolutionised music. Now, Peter, you've just released, I think in August, this new fantastic book, and it's actually beautiful in hardback, called Electric Shock from the Gramophone to the iPhone, 125 Years of Pop Music. You've actually traced the history of the relationship between technology and music through the 20th century. Why was recorded sound so revolutionary at the time that it emerged?
If you go back before recorded sound as a commercial artifact, so before the late 1880s, and it's the same for all the performance arts, the performance just existed in the moment. If you were a writer, you could write something down and you could leave it to posterity. The same if you're a visual artist. But if you're a musician, an actor, then you have to be there that second to actually hear the performance or to see the performance taking place. And so there's almost existential change in the relationship between the artist and the audience when it's taken out of that moment when it's made and it's stripped away from the environment that it comes from and taken to another place and repeated over and over again.
So the sense that people have greater control over the environment in which they listen back to the music, so it's almost disembodied from the original environment and the musicians that produced it?
It is, yep, and the ultimate consequence of that we see today when you can go onto the internet and find any piece of music from the last 125 years and you don't have to know where it comes from or who's done it, it's just there.
So let's talk a little bit about the first tech innovation in sound and where it happened. So maybe can you talk us through a little bit about the first tone tests and how they shocked audiences and how the very fact of recording ended up, some would argue, homogenising the sound of music as people began to mimic the reproductions themselves.
Right. The first recorded sound experiments were really the 1870s, a man called Thomas Edison. In terms of actually being able to go and buy a recorded piece of music, we're talking about the late 1880s, early 1890s. But at first it was a gimmick, as far as the public was concerned. They used to sort of flock, like going to an end of the pier show to see this bizarre thing, and they would hear somebody talk and then they'd hear the recording of the talking back afterwards. And what I found interesting was that right at the very birth of recorded sound, you've already got a clash of formats, which happens all the way through the history of sort of audio technology over the last 125 years. You've got cylinders and you've got what become gramophone records. And the advantage of the cylinder is that you could take, if you had a cylinder machine, you could record your own sound or your own voice or your family's voice, whereas with a gramophone record you've been given somebody else's choice of what the music is going to be. With the invention of the gramophone record as against the cylinder, you're already getting an industry rather than just a way of recording your nearest and dearest.
Now you've brought in some tracks that showcase some of the biggest changes in music in the 20th century. When was the first great technological leap?
We're in the pre-electrical era at this point, in the early years of the 20th century, and the music that people wanted to hear was ragtime and then after the First World War jazz, but that was hopeless of being captured by the recording horns that they used to use at the time. If you had a large band or an orchestra, they all had to go into the room and stand at the right distance away from this one recording horn so they would all be heard. And this meant that in the early days of recording, there were particular tones and sounds that came across very well. Unfortunately, the whole system was sexist from the start because the male voice was picked up really well, female voices not so much so. And they kept improving the recording horn and working out how, you know, to get better and better sound. But even after the First World War, if you're a singer, you were having to more or less shout to be heard over a band. And we've actually got a really good example of that. A vaudeville star from America called Elsie Janis. And this is her version of the Darktown Strutters Ball.
Oh, I've got some good news, honey. An invitation to a Darktown ball. A very swell affair. All the high drums will be there. I'll wear my high silk hat and my long strut boots. You wear your Paris gown and your new silk shawl.
So there we can kind of hear her almost shouting over the band to be heard.
She's certainly having to strain a bit, isn't she, to make sure that she can be heard.
So it's kind of almost live EQ. Sort of. It's interesting because when you hear recordings like that and recordings that we've heard perhaps in more recent years, so for instance, Madeleine Peru, when you hear her singing, it sounds as though she's singing as if she's emulating that kind of microphone-captured version of the voice. Do you find that the early recordings did change the way in which people would then do live renditions, or were people just still singing in a particular style?
I think it became the standard kind of singing, because if you think about Elsie Janis, we've just heard, her natural milieu would have been the theatre, vaudeville theatre, and they wouldn't have had microphones there either, so automatically she would have been used to singing out because she would have had the same thing. I expect there were people out the back rustling their bags of crisps or whatever they had in 1915, and the band. So I suppose they were using the same technique for the recording as they were on stage.
So we've now got a second clip, which is an electrical recording of Bing Crosby with Muddy Water and the invention of the microphone, which then gave birth to the crooner. So let's hear that first.
Muddy water round my feet, muddy water in the street, just God's own shelter down on the delta. Muddy water in my shoes, rocking to those low-down blues. They live in and comfort down there, I declare.
So what are some of the differences that we're hearing there between the pre-electrical recordings and then the electrical recordings?
He sounds so relaxed. He's not having to strain. Not so much perhaps with that track as if he was singing a love ballad, but you get a real sense of intimacy that he's singing not to a vast hall, but he's singing to one person, to the person who's bought the record, or maybe the person who sat at home listening to the radio. And so this gave the crooner generation, the 1920s and 1930s, a real sort of sexual frisson, if you like. They became like film stars because people would sit at home and listen to them, and they would imagine, this guy's just singing to me. He's not singing to anybody else.
So can you tell us a little bit about the LP versus the 45 and how these formats gave rise to actually quite different styles?
Yes, after the war, after the Second World War, as usual, the industry is thinking ahead. How can we make more money? How can we persuade people to buy new hi-fi? And simultaneously in America, you end up with two completely different new formats. Up until this point, everybody had been buying 78 RPM singles. And they were very breakable. They were 10 inches usually. And if you just drop them against the table or knock them, a huge chunk would come out of the side of them. At the same time, you get the LP coming through, which is 12 inches, and it plays at a much slower speed, so you can get anything up to 20-25 minutes on a side of a record. In terms of pop, it meant that you could create an album, and so you were presenting not just one song, you were presenting a much wider picture of the artist. So that's one format, and then at the same moment you're getting the complete opposite, which is the 45 RPM single, which is a much more durable and also better sound quality version of the 78. And there was real panic in about 1950 in America, because the consumer had no idea whether they should be buying a new record player that played 45s or one that played LPs or one that played 78s, or were they going to have, they imagined having to have three of these things around their sitting room, until somebody had the bright idea that maybe they could make a machine that would play all of them, which is where the turntable came in.
Famous turntable. So then let's talk a little bit about the tape, because it's not a particularly sexy or beautiful thing to use, but again, it changed what was possible within the recording side of things, and also then kind of gave birth to production. To hear a little bit about what we mean here, let's listen to clip three, which is a multi-track recording, and you'll hear what it is. Everyone will recognise it, I'm sure. So, Peter, who was that we just heard, and maybe why is it relevant in terms of the progress of recording and technology in the music industry?
Well, that sounded like several guitarists, but it was actually Les Paul, who's one of the pioneers of the electric guitar, and also the pioneer of multi-track recording. He was the first one who, with the help of Bing Crosby, worked out how you could multi-dub an instrument on top of another one without wiping out the first one. And on that record, he ends up actually playing six guitar parts at one time. Some of them slowed down, some of them speeded up. So it's almost like the birth of electronic sound there.
So moving then into electronic sound, and let's talk a little bit about the synthesizer, which I'm sure many of us will recognize. We're going to hear another clip now of some synthesized sound, which again, I'm sure you'll be familiar with. That was Donna Summer with I Feel Love, which came out in 1977. Peter, can you tell us why you chose that specific clip?
It's such a perfect example of synthesized sound and how you can create wonderfully compelling music out of machines, which is an idea that goes back to the 40s, really, with avant-garde music. And then in the 50s, you had film soundtracks starting to use that. And then in the 60s, George Martin, the Beatles producer, got into it. And then in the late 60s, you got the Moog synthesizer. And then from that point, it is almost a complete overturning of the old order, because you can gradually replace every human element of music. And this is the point where the old fogies go, but it's not music anymore. It's, you know, this is machines. And there is, I can sympathise with the feeling that once you get away from human beings setting the rhythm, that maybe it's a different artefact, not better or worse, it's just different. But after Donna Summer, and then you get into the 80s, you get into sampling, where you can actually take other people's music, other people's voices, other people's sounds, and bend them to your own desire and make your own sort of collage music out of that.
Yes, the rhythm's a rebel. Without a pause, I'm lowering my level. The hard rhymer, where you never been, I'm in. You want styling? You know it's time again. D, the enemy, telling you. They praise the music, it's time to play the lyrics. Some say no to the album, the show. Bum rush the sound I made a year ago.
So what did sampling mean in terms of musicianship and people's sense of ownership about their music? Were they happy? Were the musicians happy to have their work sampled, and did it create any tensions?
I think for about 5 minutes they felt quite pleased and gratified they'd been noticed, and then they realised that other people, particularly in the case of James Brown, other people were making millions out of samples from his records, and he wasn't getting paid. In the early days of sampling, there didn't seem to be any legal restraints about what you could do. And then gradually, the guys who'd been sampled came in and said, hang on a minute, I want a royalty on that. I want my name in the credits. And at that point, I think people were slightly more sparing about how much they were going to sample.
So we've just sped through some of the most fantastic innovations in music throughout the 20th century. So now, to bring us right up to date and into the future, we have Grammy award-winning musician Imogen Heap to talk to us about what's around the corner. Where do we go to now?
Yeah, so big question. As as Peter's just kind of outlined, really, the complexity of how the music industry has layered over itself each time a new technology has come on board, as each time the music industry has adopted that new technology, we're also left with the remnants in the structure, the legal structures, and the paper contracts and, you know, these things that artists would have signed over the years. And also, like you just mentioned about sampling, that, you know, then there was nothing like that in the contracts. How would they have even, how would people know what to do about that? They had to create, you know, this kind of royalty-based system out of that, of out of people sampling, because it never happened before. So what we're left with now is a very, very complicated music industry, which is so complex that it's actually really, really hard for the artist just to quite simply receive a payment for something that they have done. So right back in the beginning, you would go to see somebody play a show, you would pay the ticket price, and hopefully you would like to think that the artist would have got a bit of that money. And that relationship was direct. You were there in the audience and you saw that person play live. And now the relationship between the fan and the artist, like, in terms of conversational, you can talk on Twitter and you can, you know, be connected in that way. But as far as your music goes, the relationship between you and your fan is often very, very long and convoluted. There's so many different middlemen in the process between you, the maker, and the listener. And to the point where now there's so many middlemen in the music industry that do take various bits of that pie. But actually, I feel it doesn't really need to be like that anymore, because we're in this wonderful data-driven age and we can track payments and we can do a lot more automated stuff in terms of, you know, repaying artists without the need for a lot of these different middlemen.
Mm. I mean, it's funny, isn't it? As soon as you take it out of the realm of the music industry and you say, right, well, I'm going to get a plumber over to do this work, you wouldn't say to the plumber, well, I'm sorry, I'm not going to pay you, but I'm going to pay all these people that I had to get involved in order for you to produce this service. There's a very different psychological frame of reference when we're talking about value in terms of the production of music. What did that kind of streaming revolution do for, I would say, the devaluation of the music itself?
Well, I think what it's done is get loads more amazing music out there into the public's ears that maybe wouldn't have been able to get there on such a great level. I've reached many, many more people through streaming services and people sharing my music, you know, illegally or legally, over the years than I would have ever been able to do with just CD and performing live. So that was a really good thing. But what's happened is now when we listen to music, we often listen to it in the background of what we're doing. It's very kind of low quality often. We're listening to it on our phone, on our laptops. I mean, I'm guilty of that too. You know, we don't always have a nice moment in our day where we sit down, we put our headphones on, everything stops, and we just listen to an album. I really can't remember the last time I did that. And that's quite sad, because I spend hours and hours and years sometimes on a record working on that perfect album that I expect somebody to do that to me, but maybe there's a 0.1% of the population, people who listen to my music, would actually get around to hearing that. But at least I know it exists. But now I feel like technology is, you know, we're coming out of a curve, a kind of a dip, really, in the experience of music. As far as music getting out there, there's loads, it's brilliant, it's amazing. And actually the music industry in its large self is making a shed load of money, but it's just not coming back to the artists. So now what we have is the opportunity with a new piece of technology, which is called the blockchain. It's not so new in that it's, you know, it's been around for a few years, but it underpins what we know as Bitcoin, which is a cryptocurrency that's, you know, 9 billion, I think, in circulation at the moment. And it's an app that exists on top of the blockchain. And the blockchain basically enables, you know, us individual, one person to one person, sharing, spending money and giving that money directly to that person. And the blockchain verifies these payments through multiple kind of verifications of these people called miners, who basically verify that that person has that money and the other person then receives it. And these are called, at the end of the day, or every 10 minutes, I think they make a block, which then references the block before it, and the block before that, and the block before that, and that's why it's called the blockchain. And in it contains this information. So it's almost impossible to, you know, falsify it. And so I got excited when I realised that I could then receive money direct, perhaps from fans, direct into a digital wallet. And in that digital wallet, I could then recompensate people who had maybe helped in my song. And it just really changes the playing field. And what it does is it puts the artists in the driving seat again, because at the moment we're at the end of the food chain. We're the last people to get paid.
So it's almost like dropping a barium trace to be able to say, this is the originator of the content. This is everything that went into it. And now we're going to have like a transparent chain of custody that is verifiable, that exists and is then sort of concretized, for want of a better word, that then means that you can actually trace everything back to the source, which is the musician, to be able to say, okay, we're going to be able to compensate everyone fairly. So it's almost providing a fair trade approach for musicians so that they can produce and get a fair price for what they're doing.
Exactly. Fair trade music. I mean, that is it in a nutshell. And also feeling this kind of sense of feeling a bit fractured, in that my identity exists on Twitter, on YouTube, on Spotify, on iTunes. Each one has a different biography, a different image. But this way I could have a portal, a kind of a beacon of me, a digital representation of me.
So let's talk about your Mycelia project and your latest release, which is very exciting, called Tiny Human, which you actually released on blockchain. So let's hear a clip from Tiny Human. We've heard a little bit about why you did it, but how did you go about doing it and how was it received?
So at the moment, there are lots of apps being built on the blockchain, and there are music apps, services being built upon the blockchain. So one of them is called Ujo, and this is built on the blockchain called Ethereum. It's not the same blockchain that has Bitcoin on it. And what they've done is they've created a thing called a smart contract. So I could put in the smart contract who gets split the money to, and on what terms and that kind of thing. So it was used on the blockchain as Ujo. And what I feel like Mycelia is, it's not an actual thing that I'm making. Like, it's more of a bringing together of artists, of coders, developers, bringing us together to make a formal kind of movement to shape the direction of the music industry in favour of the artists, so that it remains, well, so that it becomes sustainable.
Coming up, we talk to composer, inventor, producer, erstwhile violin player and electronic whiz kid, Tim Exile, about his new software that wants to inject chance into electronics. That's after this.
If you've got a mobile business, you need an easy way to take multiple payment types with one integration. With Braintree, you can start accepting PayPal, Apple Pay, credit and debit cards and more. Braintree also has quick, knowledgeable developer support, so there's help whenever you need it. The Braintree V.0 SDK. One snippet of code and you're all set up and ready to start taking payments from customers around the world. To find out more and for your first £30,000 in transactions fee-free, go to braintreepayments.com/techweekly.
Now we're going to discuss some of the exciting new pieces of tech that are changing the way that we make music. And here with me right now is Tim Exile, musician and technologist and creator of Flesh. What is Flesh and when did it come out? Because it's quite a new baby.
Yeah, Flesh is a very new baby. It was out last Tuesday,
17th of November.
I've been working on Flesh for the last 2 years. Flesh is... it's kind of spurred off my main R&D project, which I call the Flow Machine. Actually, Imogen named the Flow Machine the Flow Machine. I've been working on this instrument for getting on 15 years now, which is an instrument for improvising electronic music, because I actually wanted to get back to the stage that Peter was talking about earlier, which is a sort of pre-recording stage where music is just live. That I find that incredibly exciting, and that's how I want to exist as a musician. So I sort of taught myself how to program to make this instrument. And in making the Flow Machine, I have sort of spurred off to make a couple of commercial products. The first one was the finger, then there was the mouth, and now there's Flesh.
It sounds... I have to say it sounds a little bit kinky. Why have you named the wall after body parts, Tim?
Well, I mean, so, I mean, it started off as a bit of a joke. So the first one was the finger, which is a sort of live sound processing effect, but you play it on the keyboard, so you play it with your fingers. And I think, although, I mean, it does have this kind of slightly kind of jokey, kinky overtone to it, but the idea is that behind it, I want music to be embodied. That's what excites me about electronic music. When I first heard electronic music, I thought this is something that has to be done with bodies, not with your mouse and your trackpad and your keyboard. So actually the name The Finger was actually quite an apt name. And then, of course, a year after, I made this voice synth, which sort of converts your voice into synthesizers and vocoders and stuff like that. So that had to be called The Mouth. And so now we've got Flesh, which is a more ambitious beast. And what Flesh basically does is it takes recorded samples that you've created. It could be something that you recorded on your iPhone, or it could be a beat that you've made in some beat making software. You drop it into Flesh, and Flesh kind of listens to the character of that sound and how it changes over time. And then it uses that information to then control and sequence a bunch of kind of extra sound generating engines, synthesizers really, that kind of follow, that sort of duck and dive and move with the sound as it plays.
Brilliant. Well, I think we need to hear a demonstration of that in action, so can we dive into that?
You can hear there that it started with a beat. That was a sample that I dropped into Flesh, and then everything that happened after that was generated by the way that beat moved over time. So as the timbre of the beat changes over time, you've got kick drums make a low sound, snare drums make a sort of medium sound, hi-hats make a high sound, and Flesh analyses all of that and creates these curves, which then automate these synthesizers, which flesh out. They flesh a sample out. That's why I call flesh, because it fleshes things out.
And I just have to ask from a personal perspective, because I was thinking about this in a club. One of my friends is a musician who does some interesting stuff. He created Introvox, which was recently held at the University of Arts London, where you get to interact with the camera to create certain sonographic landscapes, which is just fascinating stuff. Do you think you might create a suit which results in, well, the movement of which results in specific sounds? You can create music that you're already dancing to, that your dancing can create the music that you then dance to and respond to? Because I would totally buy one of those.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not the guy. I think probably Imogen with a glove project is probably more like
Imogen, can you make me a body glove?
I can make you a glove. There are people, you don't actually need to wear a bodysuit. You can just get a Kinect.
So I think you need to tell us a little bit about your gloves.
So yeah, the gloves are a way for me to, without being kind of hunched over my computer, the idea is to be able to pull out the sounds of the software that I love and use, and Tim's software is also very much a part of that that game. So to be able to shape sound kind of literally out of thin air. So by using different postures and movements and accelerated peaks, all the kind of stuff that you might find in a modern phone, along with bend sensors too. Recognise postures.
Just amazing. So Tim, then back to you. What do you think it's meant to the music industry that more and more musicians can self-produce and can create this kind of technology that enable them to be the technologists, basically the engineers of their own music, their own tools?
I mean, I think we're in the process of learning what's actually going to happen with that. I mean, it's really quite fresh. Personally, I think there's a whole area of music, this sort of pre-recorded approach to music, where there's a whole type of magic that we don't get to experience through the dissemination of recorded music. I mean, obviously we do, you know, we've been going to live shows ever since Edison first recorded sound and started distributing it commercially. But the live shows, the experience you get there is always, it has to reference the recording, and nowadays artists are trying to make their live shows sound as much like the recording as possible, because that's basically it's sort of turning into a catering industry where people expect a certain experience and they want to have, you know, they want to pay however much they pay to get what they heard on their headphones, but with pyrotechnics and very loud and experience with like 5,000 of their peers. But I think there's something about spontaneity, and this is definitely what I experience when I'm doing my improvised shows. I've experienced something, and I know the audience have experienced something that is totally other, and you wouldn't get from that kind of perfectly rendered rendition of your album.
It's fascinating, because hearing you say all of this, it really, for me, it really resonates with this move that we're seeing more generally to experience things in the present. So things like the Maker Movement, immersive theatre, to be moved out of our frame of reference and our expectations. Do you think that there's more of a hunger and a willingness for people to surrender themselves to this more demanding experience of music?
Well, I think so, yeah. One of the reasons behind this is actually kind of how internet culture has put us into this very kind of disembodied zone. You know, we interact, a lot of our interactions with our friends are through social media nowadays, which is very, I mean, it's sort of spontaneous, but it's kind of fake spontaneous. It's not really embodied. So I think the lack of this real sort of human contact is making people much more open and much more thirsty for people being really human in real time in a room.
So where do you think that the kinds of technology that you're creating, that we're seeing Imogen creating and people like Bjork, what do you think is going to happen next? Where do you see this going?
I don't know. I mean, I think, well, what I do see happening, if the right conditions kind of arise, is you'll just see a mass adoption of people treating music as a verb rather than a noun, really. So it's something that's done rather than something that you have and consume. And that it's an activity that everybody can engage in. Because then there's another kind of tacit message behind the perfectly produced album, which is, this is amazing. It's going to be very, 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 very hard for you to do this. And that's off-putting. I mean, the number of people that I've sort of met after shows I played who said, oh, you know, I love what you did. That was really great. I couldn't do it myself. It just makes me wither inside when people say that, because I mean, we're all musicians, but I think the perfectionism of recorded music erects this kind of unnecessary barrier for people to just get in and be musical.
Well, I think we can all get behind that. So on that note, that's all we have time for this week. Thank you so much to all my guests, to Peter Doggett, to Tim Exile, and to Imogen Heap. I am Natalie Nahai. The producer has been Alana Chance, and Ollie will be back with the next show. Until then, I hope you have a wonderful week. Thanks for joining us.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.